Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The national media are paying attention to the power grabs in Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, and Ohio. In Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker has amassed considerable power over the past 8 years. Since he lost his re-election bid to Democrat Tony Evers, the Republican-controlled Senate has approved 82 of Walker's appointments to state boards, along with a judge and two DAs. This just happened. Early Wednesday, as citizens booed, the Republican-controlled legislature in Wisconsin passed legislation to weaken the power of the new governor. Tony Evers is a state school superintendent, and he beat Scott Walker by more than 29,000 votes. He said, quote, "Wisconsin has never seen anything like this. Power-hungry politicians rush through sweeping changes to our laws to expand their own power and override the will of the people of Wisconsin who asked for change on November 6th, end quote. Wisconsin is one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. So to add to this story, state Democrats got 190,000 more votes than Republicans, 190,000 more votes, but Republicans got 63 out of 99 seats. And then there's North Carolina. Dan McCready, a Democrat running for a congressional seat in the 9th District, just withdrew his concession as state officials investigate allegations of absentee ballot fraud in several rural counties. Republican Mark Harris claimed victory with a 905 vote lead. According to witnesses and sworn affidavits, the Harris campaign, the Republican, hired political consultant Leslie McCrae Dallas to pay people to pick up absentee ballots and then discard them. North Carolina is also gerrymandered. Republicans won 50% of House votes, but they won 9 of 13 seats. So joining us to talk about all of this and to talk about media coverage is John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation and contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times. He's also associate editor of The Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, and author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. John is right there where it's all happening, and he's been writing about it. Hi, John. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Well, Rose, it's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by David Daly, senior fellow at Fair Vote, former editor-in-chief of Salon, and author of Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, an excellent book about gerrymandering. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Great to have you. Well, before we dive in on our media roundtable, we always start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Dave, let's start off with you. What caught your attention this week?
You know, I want to stick right with the topic we are talking about and praise some of the local journalists who have done amazing work to keep this, you know, power grab on the front pages. Especially in Wisconsin at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, you've got two terrific reporters in Patrick Marley and Molly Beck who have been covering this every step of the way for, you know, 22 hours at the state capitol in a row, and on Twitter and in the newspaper they have done an amazing job. There's been a lot of talk in the last couple of days, a lot of tweets from folks in the national media saying, you know, we ought to be paying more attention to this. Well, a lot of the great local journalists in the state capitals whose jobs are already incredibly hard, whose numbers are already shrinking, are doing that work. You don't have to look to the New York Times or the Washington Post for the coverage on this. You can go to the papers in Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Florida that are covering these power grabs as they happen.
Yes, so many local reporters are doing such great work. Thank you for that. All over the country. What about you, John? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'll certainly echo the compliments for some of the reporters on the ground in Wisconsin. In fact, they've done the not just the hard traditional reporting. It's physical labor because these legislative sessions have gone on for days without a break. So literally we've had some reporters, you know, like tweeting through the night for hour after hour. So it's good stuff. But I want to, you know, just expand the frame slightly and mention one other thing that's gone on, which I think is kind of an epic piece of journalism. And, you know, I'm cautious about saying such things because you never know where it ends up. But I think that there are going to be a lot of awards that go this year to a guy named Joe Bruno down at WSOC-TV in Charlotte, North Carolina. This is the guy who, you know, basically got indications that there had been potentially massive fraud in a congressional race down there in North Carolina. And he got the names, he got the data. He literally just started going out to people's houses. This is the fraud that occurred down there is that people requested absentee ballots. The absentee ballots were mailed to them. And then because the records of requests for absentee ballots are public, it appears that a Republican operative went to the homes of working class folks, rural folks, suburban folks, a lot of African Americans, but generally people who looked like they might be likely Democratic voters, picked up the absentee ballots, went to the doors, picked them up, and then we don't know every detail here, so I'm going to be careful in saying it, apparently re-voted them or restructured them so that they would favor the Republican. Where this all ends up, we don't know, but it is very possibly going to end up forcing a new election in the district, potentially the removal of a member of Congress, ultimately. And it's all because of shoe leather, the traditional reporting technique of going and knocking on people's doors and asking them questions. Really well done. So I'm going to give WSOC-TV down in Charlotte and Joe Bruno my best of for the week.
I'm so glad you did that, John, because I've been following his tweets throughout the week. I mean, he's just knocking on doors and talking to voters who are shocked when they hear that their absentee ballot may have been discarded. And then he talks to people who were hired by this consultant who say, yeah, I did this work. I took the absentee ballots and I gave it to them because I needed money for Christmas presents. I mean, these people had no idea what was going on.
Absolutely, and in fact, this is it's one of the deep dysfunctions of our contemporary politics. You know, you can definitely hire innocent folks, right? And you know, say, go pick those up. People don't know that they're not supposed to do that. We have a lot of gaps in the system. This isn't just a story that exposes wrongdoing by this particular player or this congressman or, you know, political operatives. It is also a story that reveals a stunning gap in our electoral processes. And so we shouldn't just have a new election. We should also look for ways to absolutely make the absentee ballot process secure.
Mm. And Joe Bruno is reporting that they have called Mark Harris. He is the Republican who claimed victory. He's got... let's see, I had this in the intro. How many votes is he had by? About 905 vote lead. And he's not commenting on this story. The LA Times reports that this independent political contractor has a criminal record who's worked on a long list of local and state campaigns over the last decade. A Leslie McCrae Dallas, who was hired by the Harris campaign through a Red Dome Group, a right-leaning political consulting firm. Dave Daly, it was so interesting to watch all of this unfold, really a lot of it on social media. Joe Bruno interviewing people who had their absentee ballots taken, and then he interviewed the people who were hired, and now we're learning more about the group that was actually hired to do all of this, and there's an investigation happening.
The story is absolutely amazing. I mean, this is election fraud. It is much different from what Republicans like to talk about, which is voter fraud. Voter fraud doesn't exist. Voter fraud is incredibly rare. And Justin Levitt, who's one of the foremost scholars on this out in California, has looked at, you know, 2000 through 2014 and says that there's, you know, maybe 30 cases of folks actually casting ballots who shouldn't have over all of those elections. So the problem that Republicans in North Carolina, even right now, are continuing to do, I mean, as the story is unfolding, you have a lame duck legislature in North Carolina, which lost its veto-proof supermajorities in the November's election, that is now trying to push through super aggressive voter ID bills. These are the same kinds of bills that a federal court in 2016 found surgically target African-American voters with absolute precision. And they are continuing to focus on the wrong problem. We have systemic structural problems in these elections. We have problems with keeping people from the ballots. We have problems with votes being counted accurately and being certain that everybody is allowed to vote and that all of those votes count. We do not have a voter fraud problem that needs the kind of things Republicans keep offering.
And what about gerrymandering in North Carolina? Can you talk a little bit about that, David? North Carolina is very gerrymandered, like so many states across the country. We've had you on so many times to talk about this. Mm. Republicans won 50% of House votes, but won 9 of 13 seats. Now, this election, it has been fantastic to see so many in the media, not just the independent media, focus on voter suppression. It's great to hear Carol Anderson, who wrote that great book, One Person, No Vote. She's being interviewed all over the place. But what about coverage of gerrymandering?
I think there is more coverage of gerrymandering than there was a couple of years ago. So I think that there is certainly more awareness right now of what a big problem this is. What I don't want people to do is say Democrats won back the House of Representatives, therefore we don't really have a gerrymandering problem, or a wave election can wash gerrymandering aside. That simply isn't the case. And the reality is that these gerrymandered districts actually held up staggeringly well and provided a real red levy against what was a huge blue wave. And the best way to look at this is not by looking at Congress, where three-quarters of the seats that Democrats picked up in the U.S. House were drawn by courts and commissions. Democrats actually won back only a small handful of the most gerrymandered seats in our most extremely gerrymandered states, like Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, Wisconsin, Texas. There's only a handful of seats in any of those states. And when you look at this at the state legislative level, it is just all the more obvious as to what happened. I mean, a state like Wisconsin, as you mentioned in the opening, 200,000 more votes almost for Democratic candidates statewide than for Republican candidates, and yet Republicans are going to hold on to the assembly 63-36. Democrats won 190,000 more votes, and they picked up one seat. You only had five of all of those 99 seats that were within 5%. So they've wiped out competitive elections largely in the state of Wisconsin. It's not only in Wisconsin. In North Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania, all of those states, Democrats won more votes statewide for their state houses. Republicans held on to all of those chambers. This is really important because as we head towards 2020 and 2021 and the next round of redistricting, it's not the U.S. House of Representatives that draws these district lines. In most of these states, it is the state legislatures that control this. And Democrats won back very few seats at the table for redistricting, and it's going to be such an uphill challenge to do so, because even a big wave like this year was not enough to take back legislative chambers in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, even with more votes.
John, you are in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. What is the Democratic response to this kind of gerrymandering at the state level? What are they doing about it?
Well, a few things. But, look, the original sin of gerrymandering is that both parties have generally been slow to address it. And now the Democratic Party has, in the last few years, gotten pretty good at doing so. But remember, a decade ago, Democrats in Wisconsin controlled the governorship and the legislature. And so they had an ability to deal with this when they had power. They didn't, because they thought they would continue to have power. And I only put that up front because it is an important lesson about, you know, why gerrymandering still exists and why these abuses continue. It is in part because both political parties for a very, very long time, you know, always imagined that they might get the luck of the draw. Now, in Wisconsin, Democrats have become very clear about their extreme disadvantage, and so they've taken a couple of steps that are important. Number one, there's a legal strategy, and it's not just Democrats, but a lot of good government folks and others have sued, taken cases into the federal courts, had some significant wins at the appellate court or district court level, and then through a panel of judges, giving them victories, went to the Supreme Court, didn't lose there, but didn't win. And so now, you know, you have sort of a restructuring of the battle, for lack of a better term. They were turned away. They're coming back in with another strategy. And you know, the hope is that ultimately the Supreme Court might, this is the U.S. Supreme Court we're talking about, not exactly a bastion of liberal pro-democracy activism, but that the U.S. Supreme Court might do the right thing. On the chance that that does not happen, here's what's significant about what just occurred on November 6th. In some of the states that have seen some of the most radical gerrymandering, and that includes Wisconsin, but also Michigan and North Carolina is obviously another one we've talked about, and there's a number of these states around the country. But in Wisconsin and Michigan, you got Democratic governors who come in, and the redistricting process that will come after the census in 2020, and comes pretty quickly, you now have a check and balance on the excesses of the Republicans. The Republicans in Wisconsin, after the 2010 census, had both houses of the state legislature and the governor. So they could pretty much do whatever they wanted, and they had no check and balance on them, and they really did go to extremes. Now, Governor Tony Evers will be in a position to block a bad map and force it into the courts if ultimately they can't get to a compromise, but there may even be some possibility of compromises and negotiation there. So at the end of the day, Wisconsin will have better maps. They will be much better after 2020. The complexity on it is whether that will come through a judicial process. Again, I'm skeptical about that. Or whether it will come basically via a political standoff that forces the drawing of better maps. But one way or the other, there will be competitive elections for the Wisconsin legislature. And this is the important thing to understand about Wisconsin, and also I would argue Michigan, another state to keep a close eye on. There's been a big shift in these upper Midwest states. You know, Wisconsin didn't just elect a Democratic governor on November 6th. Wisconsin elected a Democratic lieutenant governor, Democratic attorney general, Democratic secretary of state, Democratic state treasurer, and the Democrat won the U.S. Senate race. Michigan, they didn't just elect a Democratic governor. They elected a Democratic lieutenant governor, a Democratic attorney general, a Democratic secretary of state, and again, won the U.S. Senate race. The pattern here is clear. It isn't just that you know, Democrats are squeaking by in one place. There actually is a reassertion. And this sort of effort by the Republicans in these lame duck sessions to take away power and to undermine things, I think is going to blow up on our base. And my sense is that if you get anywhere near fair maps, it is quite likely that you will have a Democratic legislature. Even with all money in politics, even with all the other complexities and the personalities and everything, I do think that we're seeing a significant shift occurring in the politics of the upper Midwest. And so that's a long answer with many components to it, but goes to the heart of your question, Rose, which is what are Democrats doing? Essentially, they are reasserting themselves and winning. And so that's the trick of it. Having a governor there to say no to the Republican legislature is the first step on that. And they will have that as of January 7th.
David, what would you add? How do you see this playing out?
I agree with a lot of that, and yet I'm not entirely as optimistic as John is on some of these fronts. And that is are most gerrymandered states, and really we're talking about Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, as the ones in which Republicans after 2010 indeed had every seat at the table, and they were able to draw themselves maps on which they've been, you know, largely unbeatable at the legislative level this entire decade. In North Carolina, the governor does not have any power to veto legislative maps. So in North Carolina, the Democrats are going to have to try to find a way back to, you know, win one of those chambers, which is going to be really, really difficult. And, you know, right now it is a 10-3 state at the congressional level, and I don't see that necessarily changing on the next set of maps. Democrats simply aren't going to have any influence on those maps. In Michigan, you had a ballot initiative passed there for a nonpartisan redistricting commission to draw the maps. And one of the things that the lame duck gerrymandered Republican legislature is working on right now is undercutting that ballot initiative and taking away some of the powers of the Secretary of State to oversee campaign finance and other things having to do with the commission there, and to put that power back under the legislature. And this is also going to, you know, prove the importance of a lot of elected Supreme Court races across all of these states that, you know, we are talking about. Because odds are, if these maps do end up in the courts, then they are going to be ruled on by elected judges. And certainly one of the things we see in Wisconsin is that Republicans have been trying to move the date of the elected Supreme Court race in 2020 onto the day of the Republican primary in the spring of 2020 in order to increase Republican turnout there. So there's, you know, an awful lot of things going on. And these maps that have been forced into the courts after 2010 and 2011, we still don't have any fairness on most of those maps. I mean, North Carolina, Wisconsin, we've been fighting about the maps in these states for the better part of this entire electoral cycle now. And the courts have been so slow to actually bring justice and fairness that we continue to have elections on maps that have been ruled unconstitutional. We have to find a political solution to this problem somehow, but because the courts have just been incredibly, grindingly slow to actually bring any fairness.
David Daly is Senior Fellow at Fair Vote, former Editor-in-Chief of Salon, and author of Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. It's a great book about gerrymandering. John Nichols is National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, Associate Editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, and author of Horsemen of the Trump-ocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, 1A with Joshua Johnson and a further roundup of the week's news.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about power grabs in many states across the country. Wisconsin and North Carolina are getting a lot of attention right now. And if you have any questions or comments, what do you think of the media coverage of this? Gerrymandering. Every time we do shows, we say, you know, it's so important in the off-election season to still talk about voter suppression and gerrymandering, not just right before the election. So if you have any questions or comments about that, give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. David Daly is senior fellow at Fair Vote and author of Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, author of Horsemen of the Trump Apocalypse. John, let's talk about the power grab happening in Wisconsin. But before we do that, can you give us some context? Because there's a bigger picture here. Scott Walker's very close connection with the American Legislative Exchange Council, the organization that works with major corporations, puts legislation together and then has governors across the country sign it, in some cases not even knowing really what it is. So PR Watch had a great piece. Scott Walker has a history of signing plagiarized ALEC bills. And then there's the Koch brothers and their close connections with Scott Walker. And you've written many stories about this. Last December, Scott Walker crushes Wisconsin democracy to advance Koch brothers' agenda. So give us a little context here and talk about the power grab of Scott Walker over the last 8 years.
Yeah, I think it is good to focus on Scott Walker, because the best way to understand Scott Walker and why people in California ought to be paying close attention to him is that he really is, you know, sort of the advance guard, the first line. What Scott Walker has done politically is the framework, the template, for what you have seen Republican governors and leaders across the country do in the years since Walker came to power. And in fact, no less a figure than Grover Norquist, the conservative strategist and sort of key thinker on a lot of conservative political approaches, has said that, you know, the person really provided the framework for the Trump takeover of the GOP and Trump revolution, place where you want to see the start of things as they are now, is Scott Walker. Now, the trick on Scott Walker is that he is a electoral obsessive. And this is an important thing to understand. A lot of these people are. And that is, they're fully focused on elections. That's what they care about. They care about winning power. Once they get power, they then use that authority that they have to retain it. But it all comes back to the election, not to the actual governing. They're not particularly interested in governing. And so at the governing point, then they turn to, as you suggest, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, campaign donors, political allies, cronies. I mean, it really is in many ways a recreation of the old school machine politics of the past. The main thing is to get power. The main thing is to win elections. And then, yeah, then you just do the bidding of whoever gave you money and whoever is a crony or a buddy. In Wisconsin, where that all came together, is in a militant anti-labor agenda. Organized labor is not always aligned with the Democratic Party. Sometimes labor has, into recent years, backed Republicans in key races. But overwhelmingly, labor unions do tend to back Democrats. And so this strategy of disempowering labor is central to what Walker did in Wisconsin. He attacked public sector unions immediately and then eventually went to a so-called right-to-work law. That went straight over to Michigan. In Michigan, a right-to-work law implemented similar attacks on public sector unions. An attempt was made in Ohio, in Illinois, a similar attempt made by their Republican governor, Rauner. And you saw this spread across the country. Many of these models, fit right in with stuff that you see at the federal level, not necessarily on, a specific, strategy, but there's this approach of once you've got power, using it to make your electoral viability greater. And so all of this was supposed to guarantee permanent power, right? It's supposed to kind of shift the needle so that a state like Wisconsin, a state like Michigan would become similar to, a state like Wyoming, right, where Republicans would always win. The 2018 election upset this whole approach. And certainly Trump's a factor in this, but also the abuses, the excessiveness of these Republican governors. And so you have these sweeping shifts, not just in Wisconsin and Michigan, but in states like Kansas, where the Democrats have reasserted themselves in a major way. Major advances in Arizona. They didn't win everything down there, but they had some real big breakthroughs. Even in Texas, you're starting to see a shift. And so around the country, what we recognize is that suddenly a lot of this strategy of, focusing on elections, focusing on gaining the elections, getting as much power as you can, and then delivering for your donors, this has been upset. It's been shaken. And that's why the biggest story, I would argue, at this moment, is these desperate last-minute power grabs in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, somewhat in Ohio. We see a little bit in North Carolina. We're seeing it in Maricopa County out in Arizona. These power grabs are folks who are suddenly realizing that all of their gaming of the system didn't work. It wasn't sufficient. And they now are looking at a circumstance where their ability to deliver for their donors or their, think tanks and all this is dramatically reduced, and they're under tremendous pressure. It's not so if you anybody who thinks this is just like old crass politicians in Wisconsin or in Michigan coming up with, last minute power grabs. No. This is about a national strategy. And it's not necessarily there's some conspiracy people sitting in a room, but it is that they had an approach. It got them a very long way. Now it looks vulnerable. And in state after state, we're seeing desperate attempts to try and shift power, take power away from elected officials, give it back to the gerrymandered legislatures. That's what's happening in Wisconsin, Michigan. And also to game electoral processes. Notably, in many of these states, what we're seeing is an attempt to limit early voting so that you won't have high turnout elections. And just to clarify one final thing, in Wisconsin, the Supreme attempt to move the Supreme Court date wasn't to move it toward a Republican primary. What it was that they assumed that the 2020 presidential primary in Wisconsin, which would be held on the same day as a Supreme Court election, that you'd have a very high turnout in the Democratic presidential primary with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden and Ro Khanna and Kamala Harris and whoever else is running, right? This long list of potential candidates that in that circumstance, you'd have a high Democratic turnout. They were afraid they'd lose the Supreme Court seat, and the court being very critical of this. So this is desperate. This is political desperation on the part of people who really did, kind of put all of their stock into this idea that they could game the process permanently. Turns out they couldn't. And so now things are getting really interesting, bitter, intense. Demonstrations at the Capitol, the whole bit. It is a fabulous story that has been, I will say, for a media roundtable, dramatically undercovered by a national media that just struggles to look beyond a couple blocks in Washington, D.C.
Well, and that is the big question, and that was my next question. David, what about the national media really putting the context into the stories and focusing on the big picture, that this is really about the Republicans' agenda at the federal and the state levels. We've done a lot of shows about how the system is rigged, so the minority rules. and it's about tax cuts for the wealthy, like John said, crushing labor, privatizing so many social services, a far-right, you know, far-right racist policies. What about the bigger picture here? Do you think that the media are, you know, focusing on that enough?
No. This has been a structural plan by the Republican Party to affect elections nationwide. And Republicans took a look at what happened after 2008 when Barack Obama is elected president, when Democrats took a supermajority in the U.S. Senate and renewed their majority in the U.S. House. And folks looked at the demographics of a changing nation, and Republicans thought that they would be a minority party possibly for a generation if they didn't come up with a plan. The plan that they came up with was called Red Map. It's the redistricting majority project. It was to, you know, spend an awful lot of money in 2010 to flip state legislative chambers red, and then to have complete control over redistricting in all of these states, and then draw themselves incredible advantages that would perhaps last for another decade, if not longer. It was a plan. Republicans laid it out in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. Karl Rove, in a March 2010 piece, says this is what we are doing and this is why we are doing it. I have all of their PowerPoints and their emails in the book. I mean, this was an intentional operation. And once Republicans had control of all of these state legislatures, they went about instituting voter ID laws in 25 of 50 states, changing early voting rules, absentee rules, all of these other things that, you know, follow that once they had complete control. The national media looks at this as if it is just a political game. They look at gerrymandering as, both sides have always done it. It's really a geography as much as anything else. And they are missing the intentionality of what happened in 2010. They are missing the fact that it is completely asymmetric, this is not how Democrats have behaved, really, in states in which they've had complete control. They are missing how the technology and the big data that is used to draw these districts makes them so much more difficult for to be flipped moving forward. These gerrymanders that were drawn after 2010 are simply not the same as the gerrymanders that were drawn in 2000 or in 1990. They are more durable. They are much harder to beat. And it's taken the media an awful long time to see this. The media was in love for a long time with the big sort theory, the idea that, you know, Democrats have simply clustered themselves in big cities and Republicans are more efficiently spread out. Except, you know, now it's become really clear that a geography gives Republicans a modest political advantage, but it has nothing to do with the huge baked-in advantages that they're receiving in all of these other states because of the way that they drew these lines and these districts.
David Daley is senior fellow at FairVote and author of Rat F, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation, associate editor of Capital Times, and author of Horsemen of the Trump Apocalypse. We have time to take just a couple of calls. Sorry, my computer is freezing. Can we just take a call, and can you let me know who you are?
Hi. Am I on? My name is Mark.
Yes.
I'm in Berkeley.
Oh, hi, Mark. Sorry. My computer just came back. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for this one more show on voter fraud. I just wanted to point to the work by Jonathan Simon, whose book on redshifting, Code Red, where companies that are make a living by doing exit polls have had to shift the results of their product, which has to be within 3% to be saleable, because they're getting a 11 to 12% spread between what the voters are telling them as they walk out of the elections and what the counts are showing. In other words, these are indicators pointing to count fraud, which is the computers and all the ways that they can be hacked and all the ways that the security systems of the voting system doesn't come anywhere near the banks, you know, the financial centers and all that stuff. So there really needs to be a look at the security of the voting systems. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much. Sorry to cut you off. We're going to look into that. We will definitely continue to follow this. We are going to switch gears and talk about George H.W. Bush. I want to thank both of our guests, John Nichols, a national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and David Daly, senior fellow at Fair Vote. Thank you both for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Honored to be with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And now we're going to switch gears and talk about former President George H.W. Bush and the media coverage. We're joined now by Will Bunch, an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. He's also author of the popular political blog called Attitude. And Will Bunch wrote a piece about George H.W. Bush. Hi, Will. Welcome back to the show. Hi, do we have Will?
Hello.
Hi, Will.
Hey, Rose.
Hey, nice to have you back. Yes.
Yeah, good to be back.
Thank you for joining us, Will.
Yeah.
Well, Will, you know, since the death of former President George H.W. Bush, there's been wall-to-wall coverage of his time in the White House, and almost all of the eulogies really glossed over his hawkish domestic and foreign policies, kind of like John McCain. The same thing happened.
Yeah, absolutely, and also Ronald Reagan in 2004, which I think kind of set the template for all of this. So, no,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So, how do you explain that?
I think there was a couple overlapping things going on, as there often is in politics. I mean, one is the people that you see on national TV on you know CNN or MSNBC are inside the Beltway, kind of access-driven journalists. You know, they know presidents and these key players, and they want you to know that they know these people, and they see them more as human beings, like in their workplace, than as people who design policies that can affect hundreds of thousands of people, that can be life or death for some everyday people. They don't see them that way. You know, they see them as their colleagues. You know, they're not exactly coworker, but they don't really have the kind of adversarial relationship that you'd like to see with journalists. So that's one thing. The other thing, obviously, is we're living in the age of Trump, and Trump is so crude with his Twitter feed and the things he says and the way he runs the country that practically anybody looks quote civil unquote by comparison to Trump, and so. In a lot of ways, I think both with John McCain this summer and then now with George H.W. Bush, they're being kind of used as a civility bludgeon to say, gee, how great things were back in the old days before Trump, when, of course, the reality was, as you said, I mean, both their foreign and domestic policies were often ill-guided, if not destructive.
Well, let's talk about some of that. What do you think are the key pieces to focus on? I mean, you've got the invasion of Panama. You have the sanctions, economic sanctions in Iraq. 500,000 Iraqi children were killed. Let's specifically focus on foreign policy for a few minutes.
Well, sure. You know, it's funny. It's the 1989 invasion of Panama is almost forgotten that ever happened. And When Ronald Reagan was president, he had military advisors and others pressing him to take military action against Panama, and Reagan thought it was a horrible idea. He rejected it, and Bush jumped on the idea. I think he, was eager to prove his machismo in the Oval Office, and this was a good opportunity, you know. And it wasn't the most lethal war that America ever fought, but people did fight and people did die, and it was basically Yankee imperialism over really very kind of murky and kind of trumped up causes. And you know, then the following year, when Saddam Hussein's Iraq invaded Kuwait, I mean the Bush administration, the Bush 41 administration, practically invented the whole fake news concept with some of the propaganda they used to make the case for war. They even had a person from a PR firm kind of acting to be a Kuwaiti, saying that babies were ripped from their incubators by the Iraqis when no such thing had actually happened. And this was used to whip up people's emotions and get people on the side of the war, which, you know, was a quick victory for the United States, but the aftermath was managed very, very badly, and then leading to the sanctions, as you mentioned.
Right.
You know, I mean, basically, Bush 41's mindset was that of the CIA. I mean, he'd been director of the CIA in 1975 and 1976, and if you look at his younger record as an oil executive, he had a lot of contacts with the CIA and may have been some sort of asset for the agency. And I think that was just the kind of the way he viewed the world. He came out of that Cold War, very militaristic, or I would say even imperialistic background.
And the thing is, it's not like this was something that happened in the past and we've all moved on. I mean, this is a perfect opportunity for the media to really connect the dots between George H.W. Bush and his son and what they have done in Iraq. I mean, just Iraq, I mean, there's many other countries we can talk about, but specifically that.
Right. Well, that was the really defining foreign policy circumstance of our lifetime, really, in a way, or certainly post Vietnam, anyway. Yeah, absolutely, and you know, and if even if you want to view things through the lens of America under Donald Trump, I mean, really, really, kind of the modern conservative Republican movement going off the rails started with Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. You know, and Bush had started his political career as a much more moderate person who was, you know, pro-choice, for example, you know, had more moderate views on civil rights for the most part. There were some ups and downs. But in order to become president and to latch on to the growing conservative movement that was taking place in the late 80s and early 90s, he really moved to the extreme right and really grease the wheels for the continued motion to the extreme right that happened in the 25 years after he left office. So he's not a break from the present. He's part of the line that leads to the present that we have. And I just think journalists did a real disservice to the public by not really accurately portraying his role in everything that's happened in this country the last 30 years.
And another through line, when you look at the immigration crisis, this is another opportunity to talk about the dictators that George H.W. Bush backed in Latin America. This is directly connected to what we're dealing with today.
Right. Why are so many people fleeing Honduras and El Salvador and these other countries? You know, we meddled in their affairs. You know, we installed these generals and these hunters who generally have cracked down on labor, they've cracked down on dissidents, and have tolerated all kinds of narco trafficking and other crimes. And these countries are still unsettled to this day with, you know, extreme, you know, murder rates that are higher than the worst American cities. And these people that you see in these caravans are people who desperately want to raise their children in a place where they don't have to worry about their children being murdered. And, you know, we have a great deal of responsibility for those policies, and yet, at the same time, we won't grant these people political asylum. You know, the vast majority of their asylum requests are rejected, even though the cause for seeking asylum really roots back to American foreign policy in a lot of ways.
And we don't have much time left, but the other very important issue to talk about with George H.W. Bush is the Willie Horton ad. This is
right, and
what
and
really
rape,
started,
you know, which is again,
yep,
which,
yep.
Yeah, which is still something we're dealing with today. And to me, I actually made that the main focus of my column, just because, I mean, to me, just the word, I mean, every piece that was written over the last week used the word civility, and I can't think of anything that was less civil in my lifetime than that 1988 presidential campaign, which I still remember very well. I remember seeing those ads were on TV constantly. The Willie Horton ad aired only briefly, but an ad that basically picked up the Willie Horton theme without mentioning his name, you know, ran every half hour on TV that fall and was on constantly. And, you know, the late Lee Atwater, who was Bush's main political consultant, you know, was very open that he was, you know, using race and using white working class voters' fear on racial issues as a bludgeon to go after Dukakis on very flimsy grounds. I mean, this prison furlough program obviously, you know, wasn't the greatest, and it's been changed over the years, but it really was no different than prison furlough programs everywhere else, including the federal government, you know, which was run by Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush at the time. And even California, when Ronald Reagan was the governor, had a furlough program where several inmates on furloughs murdered other people. And Reagan just kind of shrugged that off, but it was used to destroy Michael Dukakis. And the worst thing about it, though, is it was just the campaign kind of provided the excuse, or kind of went straight into policy, actual policies from the Bush administration, to step up the war on drugs, to increase mass incarceration. There was a young man, when I say young man, he was actually a high school senior named Keith Jackson, who his first year in office, Bush decided he was going to make the war on drugs one of his main things, and he was going to make that the subject of his first speech to the nation. And what he wanted to do, his advisor said, wouldn't it be great if you could hold up a bag of crack cocaine that was sold to an undercover cop right outside the White House? Wouldn't that be a dramatic anecdote to tell the nation? And so DEA agents were told to basically entrap somebody, because nobody was actually dealing crack in front of the White House. They had to lure this kid from a neighborhood miles away to come in front of the White House to entrap him in this drug deal. And this 19-year-old kid spent 8 years in prison because of that. You know, he never got a pardon, but in Bush's last month in office, he pardoned all of his Iran-Contra co-conspirators.
And as you reported, you know, Will, a picture of Willie Horton's mugshot hung in the Bush campaign office. Well, you know, unfortunately we're out of time, but I think we should do an entire show about this, because there's just so much today that's connected to his policies, and it's so important to talk about that. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, and you can find his column, George H.W. Bush Was a Family Man and a War Hero Who Gave America Its Horribly Destructive Politics. Will, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Sorry we ran out of time there. Sorry we didn't get to take all of your calls, but you can find these stories at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.